Hi everyone, today we're going to be talking to Raed Al-Rafi. Raed is an independent filmmaker, film scholar, and multimedia journalist. He holds a PhD in film and digital media studies from the University of California, Santa Cruz. For over 15 years, Raed has worked as a Middle East reporter for national and international publications, as well as a researcher, producer, and director of TV news reports and documentaries. Since 2011, he has been making independent hybrid films that screened at international film festivals and have received several awards. His feature films include 74, The Reconstitution of a Struggle, and Here I Am, Here You Are. Raed is currently a Chancellor's Postdoctoral Fellow at the University of California, Davis, and has also been appointed as an Assistant Professor of Film and Media Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. Thank you so much, Raed, for being here with us today. And for agreeing to, share your experiences and your research and your thoughts. So my first question was about your background in like filmmaking, journalism, and academia. Your career before and during your PhD has been very rich in experience. I really admire how you tackle issues such as structural violence and decoloniality, upheaval, queerness, and revolution from these different media. So can you tell us a bit more about your scholarly trajectory? At what point did you want to tackle these concepts, not just journalistic and through filmmaking, but also academically?
First of all, thank you so much, Jihad, for this opportunity, to be in conversation with you about my work. Like, I have to say that first, I just finished my PhD, so it feels like, a big chapter of my life is over, but a new one is starting. So as you said, I am about to start Chancellor's Postdoctoral Fellowship at UC Davis, which is very exciting. But at the same time, I got this job at assistant professor job at the University of Pittsburgh. So I haven't started it yet. So I'm not yet in that position, but I will be in a year from now when I finish the postdoc. So there's a lot going on, a closing of a chapter and a beginning of a new one. I mean, they're interrelated. So I think it's a good moment to reflect also over the transition from being a filmmaker and journalist to becoming a scholar. So basically, I feel that, or I felt when I was in Lebanon, as a journalist and filmmaker, I was sort of limited in the ways I could explore some of the ideas I wanted to explore, just because mainly there's not enough support, institutional support, for thinkers and artists and filmmakers. So I found myself really needing to do another job and then on the side think about my projects, and that was not entirely satisfactory. And I was always drawn also to concepts and conceptual thinking, and I had never done this sort of intellectual work. I had done a master's in journalism, which was really hands-on and was focused on video filmmaking. So I thought maybe a PhD is a good place to really think through concepts. And my project, or thinking specifically about my dissertation project, sort of naturally came from my experience as a filmmaker making my the last feature film I made before I came to California was a queer film in a way. But I really felt my experience looking for funding and trying to distribute the film and proposing it to festivals and sending it to festivals was always an experience of being pigeonholed. And so there was a sort of narrative that was expected from a film, a queer film from the Middle East, a sort of a limited narrative of, the homosexual individual that is not understood by his or her environment, and facing the homophobia of their environment and wanting necessarily to leave and be in exile in a Western country. And I really felt that this narrative was really very limiting in the ways that it looked at the queer individual at queer subjectivity. And I wanted to really think and show how much, if we think about queer films from Lebanon and the Arab region more generally, over the past 20 years, then we see, so much richness in the way that queer subjectivity is expressed in the films. So very quickly, I decided to work on that.
That's really interesting because I also have like a background in journalism, and so I think it's nice to see like and hear about how you kind of like took your background in that and stretched it out further and then pursued it this thought like more deeply. And so building on that, how do you feel like these different media, like, so you've explored filmmaking, you've explored writing both like, you know, like poetically and personally and journalistically, as well as, you know, academically. How has it been tackling these similar issues through different media? Do you, for example, miss filmmaking when you're working on your dissertation as you're writing it? Do you feel like they add to one another?
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely really interconnected. And actually, I chose to do the PhD in film at UC Santa Cruz because it was a project-based program. I mean, sorry, wrote a dissertation, but I also made films. And the whole program was an invitation to think about critical making and critical practice and writing and conceptual work together. And it's not always like a straightforward process. And there are a lot of frictions and there are a lot of moments of, you know, clashings and doubts. But I think one of the things I can talk about is when you're filming and when you're capturing images, there's always an excess in the image and there's always meaning that is, you know, that is, that you have to look for or you have to ponder on in the image that is elusive in a way. And I think I try to bring in some of that, you know, expansiveness of the image in the image being polysemic and open to a lot of meanings and interpretations, bring some of that to the writing. So not to always look for mastery over the subject that I'm writing about, but also to leave room for, you know, hesitations and questions and multiple interpretations and to look for also not only the what is intellectual, but also what is felt and what is effective. And I think working with film invites you to do that, right? Like I am also not only producing images, but writing about images. So, you know, maybe unlike other forms of scholarship that deal with in the humanities, there's more room for this kind of thinking and writing. And I think that I brought some of that from the filmmaking world into my academic writing.
That sounds very beautiful. And it reminds me of, you know, how people say images are writing with light. I feel like this connection is interesting. And I can definitely see it in your writing too. Somehow, like, you kind of switch between scenes in your articles. It's really nice. So speaking of this idea of being an artist versus a scholar or like a journalist and an academic, one of the themes we've discussed in this cluster has been these kind of connections between art, academia, or scholarship and activism. So I've also asked different scholars who write about structural violence how they see their work as possibly connected with their activism, if they see it as such. And I know that for you, in your writing, you've written about, you know, being in the U.S. when gay marriage was legalized. I know from knowing you throughout the past year that you've also, you know, been in Lebanon during a time of upheaval, and we've talked about the upheaval in the region and such. So my question would be, how do you feel about this idea of connection between scholarship and activism, or the term scholar activism?
Yeah, I really have an issue thinking of myself as an activist, but I think it's a matter of more of terminology. So I think also activists can mean different things for different people. But I think more of an involvement with community as something that's very essential for me and for my work. So I think a lot about both the kinds of connections and solidarities that are created through the work. So for example, just to be more concrete, I can speak about different things, but just being here as queer air person in California, so in this exilic condition, in a time where, you know, where we had the pandemic and we had multiple things happening, upheavals happening in Lebanon and in the region, but also Black Lives Matter in the US, I think all of like that environment has naturally drove me to gravitate around certain communities and certain people. And so, for example, during the pandemic, I found myself in conversation with a number of queer SWANA activists and artists and writers and thinkers and just individuals. And I think that was very important, even though this aspect doesn't necessarily show up in my work. But those spaces of, so we used to meet during the pandemic online regularly. I met with different groups. One of them was more a group for conversation and healing and thinking. And another one was a storytelling group. But these groups were very important in sustaining myself and my sanity during the very difficult years of the pandemic, just being very much away from home. And then, you know, we just remembered a few days ago, the anniversary of the Sara Hegazis taking away their life. And I think that was a really essential moment that brought a lot of people together in thinking about what it means to be queer and in a Western country away from home. Mm-hmm. So, quote, unquote, in the free world, free to be queer, but also completely disconnected from your family, your friends, your community, and all of that. So that aspect, which is not maybe exactly activism, but which is just belonging to these spaces of solidarity, was very important to sustain the work itself. But then also, as I was writing my dissertation, basically my dissertation is about queer Lebanese cinema in the past 20 years or so, but I was trying to also chronicle the history of a queer movement in Lebanon and to think about how these films have dealt with political and social questions in the country and environmental questions in the country. But then when I reached the conclusion, I mean, I was writing about these films individually or about different films and different filmmakers. But then I started thinking about what connects these films and the sort of queer friendships and queer solidarities that have, you know, been created by the personal connections between the filmmakers, but also if you think of these films as an entire ecosystem. And then, you know, a lot of the filmmakers I write about have been also involved in like a myriad of political and social movements, been part of the 2019, the October 2019 revolution in Beirut. So I think it's really hard not to think about activism if you're writing about queer cinema in the region. So I don't know if I'm sorry, it just feels like maybe it's my answer goes in all directions.
I think it's a great answer, and I don't think there's, like, I think any answer to this question is better when it goes in like different directions, because it's like a question of so many different aspects to it. And like you said, like sometimes it's not even despite whether you call it activism or not, but usually there's a reason beyond just academic debate that people kind of look into these issues specifically.
I was just going to say that also I've been thinking a lot about, you know, also the idea of the queer elders. So I forgot now if it was last year, you know, just time passes in such weird ways when you're a PhD student, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
It's the notion of time. But when Etel Adnan passed away, you know, it was a moment where a lot of people were thinking about her work, her legacy, her poetry, her writing, her art as well. And I live in San Francisco. I've been living here for the past 4 years, I think, almost. And Etel Adnan spent some years in Sausalito, close to Mount Tamalpais. And this mountain was so essential for her. I mean, she drew it numerous times. She wrote about it also numerous times. And there's a book called A Journey to Mount Tamalpais. And it's just, for me, it was such a fascinating way of, you know, a queer woman being in exile and creating a really deep connection with a mountain as, you know, not only as a symbolic space and space that bears, you know, histories and mythologies and violences, but also as a natural space that you connect to at many levels. So that's maybe another aspect of really thinking about my work in terms of activism, is really trying to think about these genealogies for queer histories from our region that, you know, by thinking about people like Sara Hegazi and Etel Adnan from that vintage point of the artist in exile.
Yeah, no, I think that's really beautiful, and I really like the analogy. And I think it also relates to this next question, because I was going to ask you, after reading your piece about Pasolini, there's this one particular question that you posed that I found really interesting, and I think it relates to like thinking about queerness in the region and thinking about Salah Ghezzi and so on. You ask, what if we imagined Beirut as the heart of a queer revolution where anti-imperialist ideals and sexual freedoms are tightly interlinked? So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about how you feel that people coming from like different regions, so from like the MENA region and from other parts of the world, that are collectively thinking about issues such as structural violence and queerness and decoloniality can learn from one another, and specifically like what can the MENA region, for example, teach us about queerness and revolution in addition to queerness and exile that you've mentioned?
Yeah, so actually, so the thinking about this article, started way before I came here. The first body of, let's say, independent filmmaking work that I did with my sister Rania, who's also a filmmaker, was around the 1970s in Beirut, so right before the beginning of the Civil War in 1975. So those were years of activism, of leftist political activism, of student revolutions and workers' protest movements, of course, not only in Lebanon, but, you know, in the entire world. I spent several years really thinking about specifically the occupation of the American University of Beirut in the 1970s. And this was also the period when queer movements were starting becoming more visible in Western countries. But then when you look for those histories or for these beginnings of queer movements in the Arab region, you don't find anything concrete like that. And this provoked me to think about the existence of those movements, but in ways that are not overt. And what if we think about queerness arising not as sort of individual rights, but as force that is really interlinked with those other struggles that were happening in the 70s for social justice, for instance. And, you know, Pasolini was this really interesting figure that was actually opposed to the gay and lesbian rights movements in the 1970s, the way they were unfolding, because he kind of foresaw that they were going to be co-opted by capitalism, and he really thought of queer desire as something that is unruly. And so, I don't know, then when I discovered that he had visited Beirut in 1974, then this for me was an invitation to speculate and to think about a different genealogy for queerness in the region, and not to accept that as people, and I'm simplifying here, we heard about queerness by being exposed to Western culture or Western queer culture, and then we just sort of started imitating. So what if we think about this queerness arising from within, but in ways that are not necessarily, you know, overt? And of course, you know, there's tons of scholarship to think about how queerness, and beyond this, you know, the anachronism of the term, but in pre-modern times, in the Ottoman era or in the Arab region. So yeah, there are so many ways to think about queerness from the region. But also, I mean, I'm very interested in the idea of the in-between and of the relational, you know, how queerness arises from this thinking of ourselves and the other, of being in between, of creating relations with others that really transcends, you know, neat concepts. And so I'm thinking here about the new book of Mejdeline Shomali, Between Banat. She, as a scholar, she's someone who really think about the Arab queer critique arising from the movements of exile and from the relations that are created within the exilic condition. And again, I think this pertains again to the idea of activism that we've talked about. Another influence, I think, has been Ghassan Mousawi and his book, Fractal Orientalism, where he's thinking about non-normative sexuality, or people with non-normative sexualities, not as a minority group, but queerness as a strategy and as a way to deal with the situation or al-wada. And that makes it even more interesting. And I think that's something that I've tried to do in my writing, in my dissertation, is rather than thinking about what it means to be queer as a subject, how queerness is a way of not only looking and examining what's happening around you within your family, within your community, or within the nation, but ways to intervene and interject as an artist and to think of alternative worlds, alternative ways, and alternative connections. So to simplify, I think the relational aspect and the connection is really important. So basically, to answer your question, what does the region teach us about queerness is that queerness is also queer as a verb of reacting, of dealing with the current situation that we have in the region that is very particular, and to think with it, against it, beyond it, through a queer way or a queer lens. And that, I think that's really enriching the way we look and think about queerness.
Thank you so much. That's so interesting. And I really like this idea of thinking about queerness as a strategy. I just really like this idea of it as a verb or as a strategy. It's really interesting. Or maybe even as like a method.
We talked a little bit about queerness in the region and what the region can teach us about queerness, or what a queer lens could teach us about the region. I also wanted to ask you about the idea of pinkwashing and its colonial legacy from your perspective as a media scholar. So in other words, in light of what we see in terms of Israeli bombardment and aggression against Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, and this idea of this kind of Orientalist or racist trope of Palestinians and Arabs as inherently anti-queer, what can you tell your audience as a media scholar about pinkwashing and about how these ideas are present in films and media, and how the counter idea to that or the counter narrative to that is also present?
Yes, so I mean, pinkwashing, just to start, pinkwashing as a term is a general term, and the definition is that it refers to a marketing or public relations strategy in which a state or a company or an organization presents itself as supportive of LGBTQ plus rights or causes, often by using symbols such as the rainbow flag or incorporating queer themes in its advertising. And it's often to basically sideline or divert attention from other issues. Now, in the case of Israel, the idea that Israel is a democracy, a safe haven for queer people, is used to shift the narrative away from the occupation and from apartheid. And this has been, you know, a strategy of the Israeli government for quite some time, so it's nothing new. But we feel that it has been an intensification of the strategy, like in the current moment, during this current war on Gaza. We saw an image, for example, of an Israeli soldier raising a rainbow flag in Gaza, and this circulated widely. Or, for example, videos claiming that queer people are thrown from rooftops in Gaza or killed in Gaza, which are, you know, not always substantiated claims. Or we see also, for example, in response to posts by queer communities or queer individuals or queer people who support Palestine, we see a response that says, like, how can you support a party that wants you dead? And I have to say that really the response that I've been seeing around me from queer individuals and queer communities from the Swana region or elsewhere or on social media is like really overwhelmingly supportive of Palestine. And we see, like, I've been seeing a rejection of these pinkwashing attempts. Like, for example, there was an image that circulated widely of a rainbow flag that is melting and then a written on it, no pride in occupation. Or, for example, there are a lot of old and new Instagram accounts, like you can name like Queers in Palestine, Queens for Palestine, Al-Quds, which is a queer organization based in the West Bank, and so many. I mean, there are just so many communities and individuals who are queer, identify as queer, who are supportive of Palestine and who are making it very visible. Another example I've seen that was really very interesting is Hamid Sanou, who's the lead singer of Meshrou Leila, who's a very popular pop band in the Arab region. And, you know, like the band is openly, or some members of it, including the lead singer, Han Sinno, is openly queer. The band has been really very vocal in their songs against patriarchy and heteropatriarchy, but also against Israeli occupation and against Zionism. And, you know, if you go to the Instagram page of Han Sinno, you'll see like very clearly this support for Palestine. And for example, Han Sinno proposed a new queer flag. Called it the queer prison flag. And it's a flag that, in his own words, reunites queer liberation with socialist decolonial practice against transphobic white supremacy. And this is like symbolizes the push and the move to really have this sort of intersectionality between the fight for queer rights everywhere and, you know, fights against occupation and colonialism, colonial legacy, and colonial realities. Another example that I've seen circulated a lot is sort of a statement or pamphlet or manifesto or call to action, liberatory demand from queers in Palestine. And this is a really strong statement condemning occupation, condemning the war on Gaza that we're seeing today. And I'm going to read to you the last part of it, which says, "We queer Palestinians are an integral part of our society, and we are informing you from the heavily militarized alleys of Jerusalem to Hawara's scorched lands, to Yafa's surveilled streets, and cutting across Gaza's besieging walls, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Of course, we know how contentious this expression is, and I think, you know, this has been a subject to a lot of controversy in the U.S., with some groups considering this as a call for a genocide against Jewish people. I have to say that around me, I've seen so many activists, including actually Jewish activists, who are saying that, no, this is a misreading of what this statement says. I mean, from the river to the sea is, according to a lot of people, this is calling for a one state, you know, includes both its Palestinian and its Jewish people. Mm-hmm. So I guess there's a war of words and of slogans and of interpretation of these slogans. There is a push for queer individuals and communities and groups everywhere to make sure that, you know, that their message as queers supporting Palestine is loud and clear. Last week, for example, I took part in a protest in the Castro, and the Castro, you know, is the most symbolic neighborhood in, not only in San Francisco or in California or the US, in the world, as, you know, a place where queer rights were thrived and developed. And, you know, it's a very important place for queer communities. And there was a protest that was organized by two organizations, one called Gay Shame, and the other one is called Quit, Queers Undermining Israeli Terrorism. And a lot of members of this organization are, you know, queer elders who were part of the ACT UP movement during the AIDS years in the 90s, and who were using the same tactics like they did at Dayan in the middle of the Castro, calling for a ceasefire, calling for the end of the occupation. And I saw this as something like really interesting, sort of intersectionality and clear reflection of how queer communities are mobilizing in support of Palestine.
Thank you, Roed. I think these are very powerful examples that counter the idea that Israel is a safe haven for LGBTQ communities, which ignores the fact that the violence that it inflicts on Palestinians is also violence on queer Palestinians. So I also wanted to ask you if you have any examples of specific artists or media workers who work on these issues, or that you can recommend for people who would like to get to know about this issue a bit more.
So yeah, I mean, there are a lot of examples of queer Palestinian films or queer films in support of Palestine. But I specifically, I looked at queer cinema in Lebanon and its diaspora in my dissertation project. And so I mentioned the artists whose works I've studied and analyzed. And one of them is Roy Deeb. And he made a film in 2013 called Mondial 2010. And to me, like, this is a film that really tries to tackle the idea of resisting pinkwashing narratives through speculative fiction. So basically, the film is about a couple, a gay couple, who decides during the Mondial, so the World Cup events, you know, they decide that there's too much attention on these soccer matches, so they want to escape Beirut, so they just take a road trip to the West Bank. Of course, this is an impossible trip to make because of geopolitics. I mean, if you think of it geographically, it is just like maybe 2-3 hours from Beirut that you can be in Ramallah. But, you know, because of the border, the Israel, you cannot actually make that trip. And then basically the story goes like, once the couple is there, there's a reflection over the occupation. And at one point, the couple, they go to one of the, like, the walls or barriers, and they partake in throwing stones at Israeli soldiers. So basically claiming a place for queer people in acts of resistance against Israeli occupation. And I thought this was a very powerful film in its making as well. I mean, you never see the characters on screen. You hear their voices. They're talking about their road trip, but the whole film is from the point of view of one of them who's filming what's happening. And actually, Roidip himself, as a filmmaker, as a Lebanese filmmaker, so who cannot travel to Israel-Palestine, he could not actually go and film scenes in Ramallah. And what's very interesting is, you know, the political gesture itself of the making of the film. So he met some Palestinian filmmakers in a workshop in Jordan and asked them to film footage from Ramallah and send it to him. And then he used this footage to construct the film. For me, like, this is a very interesting example of reimagining through cinema forms of artistic resistance to those pinkwashing narratives that we talked about. And another artist whose work I looked into is called Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, and he's a Pakistani queer artist who's actually half Lebanese. His mother is from Tripoli, my hometown, mm-hmm. in Lebanon. Now he lives in Pakistan, but when I met him, he was living in San Francisco. He's a multimedia artist. He's also a performer. And the way his work is very much anti-imperialist and anti-military imperialism. And so some of his work includes this persona that he created called Falooda Islam. And Falooda Islam is a drag queen, but she's also a freedom fighter or a terrorist who's a zombie, who becomes a zombie after dying in a battle in one of the forever wars, U.S. forever wars against a country in the Middle East, and who resurrects and creates an army of zombies to avenge people killed in these imperialistic wars in the Middle East. And so in these basically experimental essayistic videos that Zulfikar Ali Bhutto creates, there is a strong response to colonialism, imperialism, Israeli occupation. And specifically, I'll mention one film called Resurrection 573, where Zulfikar, through the actor of Falooda Islam, which he himself embodies, he revives the legacy of Sana'a Mhaidli. And Sana'a Mhaidli, for those who don't know, is a Lebanese freedom fighter activist who did a suicide operation against an Israeli tank in the south of Lebanon when it was occupied by Israel in the 1970s, end of the 1970s. And herself, she was actually Christian, Lebanese, but belonged to a pro-Palestinian militant party and was at the time 18. And she left a video testimony to talk about why she's carrying out this operation and urging her father not to mourn her death, but to actually celebrate it as an artist or wedding to the earth, and talking about, you know, the injustice inflicted on Palestinians. And Zulfikar uses this material, this footage, to really remember this form of feminist queer resistance. And I think that's an important gesture because an artist like him is thinking about the long history of resistance to Zionism in the region that takes multiple forms, right? And this is maybe something else that we're seeing. We're seeing a lot of films, you know, that are kind of forgotten, that show solidarity with Palestinians in the 60s and 70s. I saw one now, I don't recall the name, but a film about an archive of, you know, Palestinian or pro-Palestinian imageries and films preserved in Japan, for example, or made by Japanese filmmakers or Italian filmmakers, or it was a Swedish documentary that I saw in a screening in Auckland the other day about Palestinians in Gaza in the 1980s. So there is now an interest in going back in time and really reflecting over like the history of the Palestinian struggle, because one of the things that I think Western media has been doing recently is show that in many ways that are subtle and overt, to show that everything that is happening right now is a response to October 7th. And basically to erase the long history of dispossession of the Palestinian people, of all sorts of violence against Palestinians, you know, that starts in the 1940s and even in the Nakba, but even before, like in the 1930s or from the beginning of the Zionist movement. And so with social media, we're seeing a circulation of archival information, archival images of all forms. And this is, I think this is really powerful.
That's all very interesting. I think one of the things you said, like now and in your answer to my previous question, that I think really stands out is the fact that it seems like Palestine is also a very transnational issue. Like there are so many people from all over that feel passionately about the Palestinian struggle, or like you said, in San Francisco, these same people that were protesting over the years for different struggles are also protesting for Palestine now. And so it like reminds me of this idea, which we had talked about outside of the podcast, like the intersectionality of the Palestinian struggle. And so I think that that's very interesting. So many of the artists that you mentioned and so many the movements that you mentioned are not Palestinian themselves, but that they relate to this issue or this struggle so much.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, we're seeing these forms of solidarity. I mean, a Jewish Voice for Peace, for example, is one organization that has been really pushing for a durable and indefinite ceasefire. They've been, you know, criticizing the occupation. It's definitely not limited to only Arabs or Palestinians, the kind of support that we're seeing. It's from people everywhere. And, you know, and I have to mention that, I mean, we should not deny that there are forms of anti-Semitism that are really ugly and dangerous and should be condemned. But I think this is work that is also being done by a lot of activists and a lot of queer activists to really make sure that the opposition is not to the Jewish people or to the Jewish faith. It is actually to a government, a way of an ideology that is built on dispossessing Palestinians and driving them out of their land. And those nuances are very important. And yeah, I just needed to stress on that this is what I'm seeing from my observation, that the intersectional movement, but it is also one that tries to stir the discourse in a direction that is not at all against the Jewish people as people or their faith, but against a colonial ideology, a colonial practice, an apartheid ideology and practice.
I think that this idea of when people talk about Palestinian liberation as part of everyone's liberation, this everyone also includes Jewish liberation. Thank you for the recommendations, because one of the questions was about
whether there were certain books that have really inspired your work, whether they're academic or otherwise, or films that you found inspiring that you would recommend to listeners or to people interested in learning about structural violence and queerness and such.
Yes, I mentioned Majdaleen Shamali's new book, Between Banat. I think Amaya Mekdashi's new book, Sexitarianism, is really, really eye-opening and inviting us to think about sexuality and gender in the Lebanese context, or thinking about sectarianism or the making of sectarianism in Lebanon by thinking about sexuality and gender. And these two scholars think a lot about archives, the making of archives, and also counter archives or alternative archives. So yeah, thinking about archives has been also very essential for me. So of course, I think one really amazing book that I always go back to is The Archive of Feelings by Anne Svetkovich, and also the writing of Sarah Ahmad on affects, and that always invites me to think about, you know, dimensions of archives that are not material and what it means. And I can give you a specific example. As I was working on my thesis and I was thinking about what do I include in my writing? What are the works that I'm going to write about? And how do they constitute an archive, right, of films? And what does it mean to basically to write about a film? What is a film? Especially in a region where, you know, cinema in a country, specifically Lebanon, where cinema is not an industry or supported by institutions, where a lot of artists also work with the audiovisual, so make videos and experimental cinema. And so in assembling a body of work to write about, I started thinking about forms of cinema that are expansive. And specifically, for example, I wrote about video collages that are very short, made by Nasri Sayed, who's a multidisciplinary artist and who has an Instagram account called Radio Quarantina. Maybe a lot of people from our region know about it. That started during the pandemic from Beirut to the world, as it says. But it was very interesting to me that these video collages, which were basically, and I think he's still making them, he takes moments of performers, of belly dancers, of divas from classical Egyptian films or from Arab television, and he reworks them through like subtle edits or subtle repetitions, or sometimes he adds another kind of music. So really thinks about movements and gestures, and then puts these very short video collages online. So for me, this is also a sort of cinema and an alternative shadow archive that is, you know, rethinking or doing a queer curation, a queer reading. I mean, to borrow from both Shomali and someone like Gayatri Gopinath, you know, like contesting the idea that our official archives or our archive of Egyptian cinema is heteropatriarchal and is heteronormative. It's really contesting that by thinking through this archive in new imaginative ways. So another reference here is an amazing book by Catherine Russell called Archivology, where she thinks about practices by artists who work on digital archives. And she comes up with this idea of the awakening of women from the gendered archives of cinema. Just to say that, you know, as someone who works with digital media and with film, we are in this amazing moment where, you know, as writers, as artists, we can really contest that supposedly hetero-patriarchal, heteronormative history of ours. And that's something I really try to also highlight in my work.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And thank you for the recommendations and the references, social media references too. And I remember when we were working on the upheaval graduate study group together, I also really enjoyed like how you spoke about upheaval through people who do comedy or people who do dance. So I think that really relates as well. And I also wanted to ask you specifically about your PhD journey, and you've already shared with us some anecdotes and some of your experiences. So I wanted to ask you if there's something that happened throughout your research period that kind of stuck with you, or that changed how you thought about these concepts previously, or maybe just like an anecdote that you feel like would be interesting to share.
Yeah, I mean, this definitely, these past 6 years have been filled with tremendously life-altering moments, not only, you know, for someone from Lebanon, but for, you know, someone on this planet, basically. So I think everything that happened, you know, from, you know, the revolution in Beirut, in Lebanon in general, and the financial crisis, the pandemic, also we had the COLA movement at UC Santa Cruz. So the sort of like constant precarity was something that I, you know, had to constantly compose with, because you and I both know that, you know, for us to come to California, not have family here or necessarily, you know, networks of support, both emotional, financial, and all of that, having to create those. So in a place that is extremely expensive. So, you know, thinking about precarity also in material ways for PhD students, combined with the fact that, you know, the financial collapse happened in Lebanon, that definitely like also affected me. So I think just having to really deal with that precarity all the time and that at the same time produce knowledge definitely affected the way I think and the way I thought about my project. I just wanted to point to the myriad of effects of those conditions on the self and what you end up producing. So maybe it's not like thinking about specific moments or specific anecdotes, but it's definitely something pervasive that ends up like really permeating the whole thinking process and the whole work. So, you know, something as simple as, you know, not being able to afford for a period of this age to live alone, like to have even to live in a studio in a city like San Francisco on a TA salary. Having to live with five other people during the pandemic and the sorts of anxieties that creates, but also the sorts of solidarities and community that creates. And that definitely had an effect on my work. So writing about Lebanese filmmakers, Lebanese artists from my home in San Francisco, you know, I'm Lebanese. I was born and raised there, but I'm also very far from what's happening. And, you know, that distance also makes you think about your positionality. So all of that, you know, definitely has transformed the way that I initially thought about my project. And again, I think to go back to something we said in the beginning, it makes you really approach your subject matter, not from a desire to master it, but to think with it and through it and from your unique perspective as someone who's writing about your region and something you're part of, you know, me being like also a Lebanese filmmaker, but from a distance, from the position of the artist in exile and what that means and how this is reflected in the work was something that really was very essential for me.
Yeah, I think that answer is very real because the things that happen while we do the PhD, the precarity and the upheaval, it's not separate. We're not directly writing about it. It's not separate from the process. And so I think that's a really good point, especially like when you're writing about something that relates to structural violence or decoloniality or any of these themes, and you're so also affected by it, it seeps into your work. So thank you so much, Ra'id. I have one last question that I was wondering about, which is there anything that I may have missed in my questions that you would like to share or talk about? Maybe like if there's like a current project you're working on or something, a new direction your research is taking?
You know, I mean, I think this is, as I started saying, I mean, this is a moment where you're supposedly, as you hear so many people say, like, congratulations, you finished your PhD. Now, you know, take some moments to, you know, breathe or reflect. And so it is a moment of pause and for me a little bit. But I'm also thinking about how can I diversify the way I write? Because as someone who came from a journalistic background, so was trained to write in a certain way and to think efficiently about the writing and the into like the academic world where, you know, things take ages to be published and you're really supposed to think something through for years and be quizzed about it and questioned about it. And so it's a very painful process to write academically, as we all know. And so I want to think about ways of writing that are also not so rigid in the academic sense. And of course, I mean, I think we're in a lucky moment in academia because there is already a legacy of specifically feminist scholarship that really thinks about affect and emotion and process and positionality in the writing. So that makes the writing more real and more alive. And again, less about mastery and more about reflection and questions. And so, yeah, I mean, concretely, then I'm really trying to think about how are ways I can think and write outside the monograph, the edited volume, the peer-reviewed journal. So I just finished writing a chapter for a book on queer Arab art, it was an invitation. So the chapter started with an idea that was commissioned to me, it was to write in a combined way about the films of Yusuf Shaheen and Yusri Nasrallah from a queer perspective. And I really liked the way that the people who commissioned the work, it's an organization called Haven for the Arts based in Beirut, and it felt like a way to think outside the academic mold about these films. So I accepted the invitation very quickly. And it was a very interesting way to think about these films and analyze them by also thinking about the way I saw these films and I was seeing them again as an Arab queer individual. So yeah, I'm trying, to the short answer, I'm trying to think about ways to write and think that are not necessarily understood as only academic. Because I think it's also liberating.
Yeah, I agree. And also, I told you, like, I really enjoyed reading your articles. And I think, like, you write really beautifully. And you insert yourself in your writing in a really, like, intriguing way. And so I'm excited to read this work that's been commissioned from you. And, you know, I admire that style of writing.
Thank you so much. And it is also, it's something I try to do also in my essay films as well. Mm-hmm. Like, think about scholarship through the images and through the essayistic mode of filmmaking. So, and it's all, I position myself within scholarship, at least in film and media, that is trying to think of new forms of thinking and writing with the image, through the image. And I certainly, that's what I would like to develop further in my work.
That's really amazing. I'm excited for your work. And also for you that you finished your PhD. Congratulations. And like you said, you can use it as a time to hopefully rest. Thank you so much, Roed, for your willingness to do this and for sharing all this knowledge with us and sharing your experiences. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jihad. Thank you, Orfalea, also for this wonderful opportunity.